And now, the podcast about movies for people like movies. Welcome to Snubs.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Snubs Podcast. This is Josh, and that is Dan. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Josh. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing today?
Good. More or less the same as I was an hour ago when we recorded the last episode.
I wasn't going to get into the fact that we did two in one day.
No.
But happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. What'd you do for Thanksgiving?
I went to my family's in Boston for first Thanksgiving with my new wife, Brianna.
Oh, yeah.
So that was
wonderful.
Cool. It's great.
You guys had a good time?
We had a great time. It was really fun. We were there just a few days, and then we had to come back today. She had some gigs, and I had some this to do.
Let me just say, when you call her your new wife...
It's weird, right?
It makes it sound like you have an old wife.
Yeah, well, my first three wives already were... They're settled in my family. This is my new wife, so...
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Thank you for clarifying.
Brianna, if you listen to this... just ignore all that stuff. Anyway, welcome to Snubs Podcast, the podcast about my wives, and where we discuss films that maybe deserved a little more credit than they got in their time. Now we're talking about 1996, a fantastic year for movies, and a couple movies that should have been, if there was the... imaginary. Dan, why don't you go ahead and take it from here?
Okay, sure. That's fine. the premise here, and we're now almost, I guess, sort of halfway through what you would consider to be the season here, is that we are imagining a world in which the popular film Oscar existed in the year 1996, and we are debating what movies from that year should have been nominated for that imaginary Oscar, and then in a couple of weeks, we're going to have an episode where we have an imaginary ceremony where we decide who won. So, again, just to, I think, run down our picks really quickly for 1996, we had Independence Day, which we both agreed on. I also had The Birdcage, The First Wives Club, Twister, and Scream.
And I had Mission Impossible, That Thing You Do, The Long Kiss Goodnight, and The Rock.
So then the previous episode, we talked about The First Wives Club versus The Long Kiss Goodnight. I think that we jointly decided that The First Wives Club would be moved on to the next round. So now we have Independence Day and First Wives Club amongst the five nominated mm-hmm. for this imaginary Oscar. Mm-hmm. And today we're going to talk about the number two and number three highest grossing movies domestically of the year, Twister, which was my pick, and then Mission Impossible, which was yours.
And I can't wait.
Yeah, me neither.
Let's do it.
Great. Let's get into it. So both of these movies were really significant blockbusters. Twister made $240 million domestically. Mission Impossible made $180 domestically. Both of them came out actually in the same month. So Twister opened on the 10th of May. Mission Impossible opened on the 22nd of May. Both of them came from really interesting directors. Both of them have a really interesting cast. So we're going to get into it, but we're going to start with Twister, I think.
Sounds great.
Great. Twister. So Twister was directed by Jan de Bont, who is a really super interesting career. He was primarily, over the course of his career, a director of photography, as opposed to a director of film. So he's only actually directed, officially, five movies. He directed Speed in 1994, which is awesome.
First movie.
First movie.
Right
out
the gate.
Good first movie.
Unbelievable.
Maybe this should just be a podcast about good first movies.
Whoa.
That'll be a different thing.
That's Speed, a good idea, actually.
Then Twister. Sadly, he dipped back into the same well too quickly with Speed 2, Cruise Control, which is horrible. Also...
Bad pun also for the title.
Yeah.
Because it's on
a cruise ship.
Cruise.
And let me tell you, cruise ships don't seem like they're going very fast. Then The Haunting, and then the first Tomb Raider movie. Lara Croft, Tomb Raider, The Cradle of Life. I think that was the first one. I guess I should probably check that that wasn't the sequel. But as a cinematographer, he has a really sort of long and storied career where he was working with lots of interesting directors over time. So he did the photography for Flesh and Blood with Paul Verhoeven. He did Die Hard. He did The Hunt for Red October, Flatliners, Basic Instinct, Lethal Weapon 3, a bunch of really interesting stuff. One of the things that's on here that doesn't really make any sense to me is Leonard Part 6, which anybody has ever seen that, it's a very weird secret agent spoof movie with Bill Cosby that will probably never be shown on television or in any other medium ever again.
You have seen this movie?
I did. I had it on VHS when I was a kid.
Is it Part 6 of 6? Nope.
The joke was that it was just called Leonard Part 6.
Hilarious.
Yeah, I guess. Anyway, Jan de Bont, interesting weird guy. Interesting career. And so this was his follow-up, essentially, from Speed.
Speed did pretty well.
Speed did do pretty well. We should check on where it ranked in the box office of that particular year. But for Twister, you have basically a great cast. So Helen Hunt, Bill Paxton, Cary Elwes, Jamie Gertz, Philip Seymour Hoffman, a bunch of character actors that you'd probably recognize as well. Helen Hunt was in Mad About You at this time, and was just a few years before As Good As It Gets. Bill Paxton had been in Apollo 13 and True Lies, Tombstone. I mean, he'd been sort of working for a long time. Cary Elwes was sort of towards the end of his run, I think, because Princess Bride, Days of Thunder, Hot Shots, the Crush, Robin Hood, Men in Tights, all of those things sort of petered out in 1993.
Oh, wow.
And then
that's sad.
Jamie Gertz was also sort of more of an 80s star. I mean, she was in The Lost Boys and Less Than Zero and a few other movies like that. And at this point, she was more kind of back to TV. She ended up on ER after this, Ally McBeal, and so on. So that's kind of the setting in terms of the cast. And, you know, I should have mentioned Lois Smith as well, who plays Aunt Meg, who is wonderful in this movie.
She is great. Speed, by the way, number 3 in the box office in 1994.
Oh, that's interesting.
With $121 million, quadrupling its budget.
Does it say what's number 2 and what's number 1 there?
I don't know. Yeah, it does. Somewhere.
Okay. It's fine. It doesn't matter.
Oh, sorry. Maybe it was number 8? Yeah, it was number 8. Sorry, Speed was 8. Number 1 was Forrest Gump. Lion King was number 2.
Okay, gotcha.
Et cetera. Flintstones was number 5. We'll get to it.
How much money did Speed make?
Speed, $121 million.
Okay, so this essentially made double the take of Twister made double the take.
Yeah, but I guarantee you it cost a lot more.
Yeah, I think that that's probably true. So, you know, I think that there's a couple of interesting things that we should talk about here. But let's just get into what kind of works and what doesn't. So the premise is Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton play...
That's $92 million versus Speed's $30
million. Okay. Yeah. Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton play sort of an estranged couple, both tornado chasers who had been chasing tornadoes in the middle of... Oh, this is going to show my coastal elitism. Where does this take place? Kansas? Something? I don't know. They've been chasing
in
tornadoes.
The Tornado Alley!
Yeah, they've been chasing tornadoes in the middle of the country for a long time. Bill Paxton escaped the life. At the beginning of the movie, he is engaged to Jamie Gertz, who plays a sex therapist, which we'll get back to later.
His therapist?
No.
Am I wrong about that?
I think so.
Oh.
She's a therapist.
Okay.
Maybe that's how they met, but that seems like it would be introduce a little bit of an extra layer of weirdness to it.
I wouldn't mind an extra layer in this movie.
Yeah. Fair. I think that's going to be your beef with this. In any case, he has to get... It's a very simple conceit. He has to get Helen Hunt to sign the divorce papers. He's bringing Jamie Gertz along with him. And this happens to be on the same day, which is like the worst ever possible tornado day in history.
Yeah, 3 in a row. 3 big storms right on each other's backs.
4.
4.
4, because there are 4 Dorothys with those little silver balls inside of them.
Oh, four stars. Got it.
And they get it on the last one. Yeah. So the entire movie, I mean, there's very little plot. Their whole deal is that they want to map the inside of a tornado so that they can come up with a better early warning system. Helen Hunt's saw her father die, or Helen Hunt's character saw her father die when she was young, sucked up by a tornado. And so she's very intent on sort of breaking the scientific frontier and providing a safer early warning system for everybody. There is a team of rival tornado chasers that kind of like don't really matter and are just there to generate some conflict, and they are led by Cary Elwes. Basically, the whole movie is Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton chasing around tornadoes.
Yep.
That's it. Is that a fair summary of the plot?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ephemera. I mean, there's a supporting cast, which I think is pretty great, who are a lot of fun and add a lot of fun to the movie. But you're right. For the most part, it's just, yeah, the two of them. I mean, the conflicts are pretty, they're half-baked, I would have to say.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot about this movie that is kind of flimsy. Like, all of the supporting cast are all defined, like, by one minor trait. Like, there's a guy that has a hat. There's a man who wears glasses. I think that they might call him a professor. I can't remember. It's stuff like that.
I don't remember that.
Really.
Philip Seymour Hoffman gets pretty close to licking Jamie Gertz in the face. That's a moment.
Yeah. So, let's... So, what works for you and you, what doesn't?
Okay, well, for me in this movie, what works is... there's really no preamble in this movie to what it's going to be like. Because Bill Paxton is himself and lovable and awesome. He walks in onto the screen and is immediately just a fun kind of... He doesn't seem fully secure in any of his convictions, I think is nice. He walks in and he's talking about how he's going to get the divorce papers. The second sees Helen Hunt, that doesn't really happen. She is the MVP of this movie for me. She kicks so much ass. But the two of them together are a great on-screen couple. I think that's pretty clear. That works for me. Also, like I mentioned, the supporting cast is a lot of fun. And the third thing that works is that this movie has zero lulls to it, and it just goes. And for what it wants to be, which I think is just a chance to show some pretty sweet special effects and a thrilling, I mean, it's a thriller, just thrilling thrill ride, thrilly thrill fest. It just keeps going. I mean, it's like, oh God, there they go. The truck just flipped and oh no, there's another tornado and there they go. So that's the movie, start to finish.
Yeah, I mean, it is sort of relentless. The only two kind of lulls that they have are both really related to Lois Smith and Aunt Meg. So there's the first scene where they're eating breakfast at her house, and then there's the second scene after her house is destroyed where they're trying to figure out what to do.
And she carries us through those, I think, pretty well.
Yeah.
Oh, I almost forgot to mention the intro, which I love, where Helen Hunt, as a little girl, watches her father horrifically sucked away by a tornado.
Yeah.
I really thought they could have got deeper into that, but I think that about pretty much everything in this movie.
Yeah. All right. So your issue with your beef with this is that it's kind of flimsy.
How'd you know? Because I keep saying it. It's just there are multiple conflicts in this movie, which they show you for 2 seconds and then they don't matter anymore.
And I guess so.
One of them is Helen Hunt's trauma that's led her to this life. Which barely you see registering in her as an adult, unfortunately.
I think that if it was a different actress in this lead role, I would not like the movie nearly as much. I think that she is great and she carries the whole thing on her shoulders. And I love Bill Paxton too, but you know, he's mostly there for the ride.
Yeah.
And it really is her movie.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I think it's great that, like, you know, 1996, there was basically a female-led action thriller that was number two at the box office. What works for me really is the cast. Love Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton. Not sure what Philip Seymour Hoffman is doing, but it's always nice to see him.
Yeah.
Cary Elwes is kind of a blip. Jamie Gertz, always love. Lois Smith is really great. But the reason to love this movie is the CGI and the special effects. I remember seeing this at the time and losing my mind over how cool it was. And I think that actually, so it's a little bit tricky. There are some things that have held up really well in terms of the way that it looks, and there are some things that look very, very cheesy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the cow floating across the road doesn't look great. All of the shots of Twisters off in the distance, and some of the stuff where they're stuck in the middle of it looks really good, and it still holds up. And ultimately, you have a criticism of the movie for being flimsy. I like it because I think it's a very clean and a very clear script. It all happens in one day. There's a very clear narrative tension, or rather two narrative tensions. Will Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton get back together? Will she sign the divorce papers? And are they going to be able to successfully implant Dorothy in one of the tornadoes? And you get both of those questions answered basically over the course of 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. And you know what the structure is going to be right away because they tell you at the beginning there are four Dorothy units, and the minute that they start to lose them, you're like, okay, the last one they're going to get, and there's going to be some turn that allows them to get it. And that turn ends up being Lois Smith's
soda?
Yeah, soda. Well, soda art. Oh, soda art. So it's great. I mean, it is very thin in a lot of ways, but for what it is, I think it's a great example of this particular genre and how you can make a movie like this really work. There's a couple things about it that I do not like. We covered the fact that it is dumb. I think, you know, the thing that people criticize the most in terms of the script is it's that Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton are essentially sucked up by the Twister in the end, and they're hanging on to a pipe that's stuck in the ground with a belt.
I wonder how many lines that was in the script.
I don't know. It gives you this wonderful shot where they actually are in the center of the tornado and they've made it into the eye, but I think the whole reason that they did that was just because they thought that shot was going to be kind of cool.
Yeah, they were right. It is cool.
It's cool, but it's
hilarious.
Yeah, it's not great. The other thing, I have always had a soft spot for Jamie Gertz, and I think that they really kind of do her dirty in this movie. Much is made of her being a sex therapist, and that's kind of like a running joke where she's answering the phone in the car, and it just feels like it's a little bit of extra tension that feels kind of a little bit unkind and cruel to her character.
Well, she like kind of, she it's not that she doesn't keep her dignity in the movie, because she does walk away from a situation that is clearly, you know, Bill Paxton's not going to last as her fiance.
Yeah.
But it makes you wonder how she got to the point where she felt it would be a good idea to be engaged to this guy.
Yeah. Because that's true.
You're not really seeing him change.
Yeah.
When he comes around Helen Hunt, he just is who he is.
Yeah. Part of it, I have to say, is probably that it's more of an emotional rather than an intellectual reaction on my part. I just really like Jamie Gertz. I wish that she got a better ending.
I had the same reaction, and I don't have a soft spot for Jamie Gertz at all.
Okay.
But I really felt that it was, I mean, I guess the word I use is half-baked.
All
of a sudden, she says, well, I'm leaving. And he's like, what?
Yeah.
She's like, yeah. And he's like, okay.
Yeah.
It's kind of just like, oh,
and
oh,
I think
that just happened to his engagement. Okay,
it's super fair to say that this movie is half-baked. It really is. The thing that is fully baked is the action sequences and the special effects.
Yeah.
And everything else feels a little bit flimsy and a little bit low stakes too, right? Like they have this entire caravan of character actors following them around.
Doing nothing.
Well, they do a lot. There's a lot. There's a guy with maps that I forgot that's somebody else's character trait. There's a man with maps, but you know, it's all just like kind of silly and low stakes, and nobody ends up there's no weight to it. Nobody, like, even Aunt Meg, who was injured in the Twister, you know, she makes it out just fine. There were like a lot of original songs that were put together for this movie. I think there's a Lisa Loeb song that's really quite good on the soundtrack, and that's it. That's all I got on Twister. I picked it because I think, it's the number two movie of the year. A lot of people saw it. I remember seeing it as a kid. It does play a fair amount on TV, and it is really good for what it is. But then on the other hand, we have Mission Impossible.
Yes, we do. My pick, a great pick. This was once your pick, I believe.
We switched at some point, I think.
We went back and forth, and we don't need to talk about that. My pick was, well, I'll just say it. It was executive decision. I think it's, I still think it's a pretty great movie, but it's pretty low on the box office. And as we talked about this more and more, I realized it doesn't really maybe have the cultural import that we're looking for.
Just even the notion that executive decision has any cultural
impact. If there's anyone out there listening who wants to fight for executive decision, please, please call in or write us or do whatever. And, you know,
yeah.
At bleep.com. So, yeah. Anyway, point is, Mission Impossible movie is a movie that we both immediately saw on the 1996 list, and we're like, this was a fantastic movie, and it's a great movie for us to talk about, because partially for the reason of the longevity that it's had in our culture, both for its star, who was a star before this movie but was definitely elevated by it, and the franchise Mission Impossible. We just had the sixth Mission Impossible movie after 22 years. So definitely a long-running franchise that's, you know, on the level of something like...
He is still running.
He's still running.
A lot of runs.
He's going to be running.
A lot of big runs.
But let's run it down a little bit. Dan, do you want to give us some context for Mission Impossible here?
Sure. So let's see. So this was at a time when, you know, Tom Cruise was trying to work with a lot of big name directors, and so I believe that he helped arrange Brian De Palma for this. Brian De Palma had directed a number of movies over the course of the 80s that were very well regarded, critically acclaimed. So we had Blowout, Dressed to Kill, Scarface, Body Double, Wise Guys, Untouchables, etc. And this, I think, really is kind of like one of his last really well-regarded movies, because then we sort of move on to things like Snake Eyes in 1998, Mission to Mars, which I always get confused with Ghosts of Mars, you know, that Mars zombie movie with Natasha Henstridge and Ice Cube.
Sure.
I was looking at Brian De Palma's IMDb before, and I was like, oh, he did that? That doesn't make sense. But, you know, he is an excellent director at building set pieces for maximum tension, and we see that really in the Langley sequence most of all in Mission Impossible. So he's, you know, kind of at the top of his game. Tom Cruise wants to work with him. Tom Cruise is coming off of a bunch of great movies: A Few Good Men, The Firm, Far and Away is not a great movie. We're on the 4th of July, Rain Man. So he's like, this is sort of the height of his stardom. I think that this is, you know, he's been in some movies that could be considered action movies, I guess, but this is really his first big franchise action movie. This is also the same year that he is in Jerry Maguire, so this is like a really big year for
that.
Tom
is insane.
Cruise. Yeah, I can't think of another example of an actor today who would be in two movies like that in the same year. John Voight, I don't really know what you can say about John Voight. He'd been in Heat and a couple of other things. He goes on to be in Anaconda, which is my favorite John Voight role.
But that's crazy to me. I mean, not that I can really name a bunch of other movies that he was in, but it's just, you know, he has a certain... I mean, okay, well, he was in, you know, movies in the 60s and 70s too, so...
Yeah, he'd been around for a long time.
Catch 22.
Yeah.
I don't know many of these movies, to be quite honest with you, but he brings to the screen a certain, I don't know, legend status. He shows up and you're like, oh my God, John Voight. I don't know why.
Sure.
Maybe it's partially because of this movie.
Quick disclaimer for anybody listening: do not agree with John Voight's politics.
Oh, yeah.
We should just put that out there right away. Do like this performance. Don't like him as a person. Emmanuel Baer plays his much younger wife. She's a French actress, a very famous French actress, and well-regarded French actress. She's been nominated for, I think, 8 César Awards. And then, you know, pretty good cast rounded out by Jean Reno, coming off of The Professional. Ving Rhames had just done Pulp Fiction. He was in Dave. You remember he was in Dave? I forgot about that.
Oh, who was he in Dave?
He plays the Secret Service agent. Oh, he has that really sweet moment at the end with Kevin Kline where he's like, I would take a bullet for you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Top of his game.
Top of his game.
End of his game, I would say.
End of his game.
Yeah, I know he keeps doing Mission Impossible movies, but I don't know. that's true. His best moment. I don't like him in the newer ones.
Well, we can talk about that. Yeah. We got to talk about some of the newer Mission Impossible movies. We should say, I mean, this also started, it launched a franchise in which each installment was directed by a fairly big name or at least interesting director. Mm-hmm. So one is De Palma, two is John Woo, mm-hmm. three is J.J. Abrams, four is Brad Bird, five and six have been Christopher McQuarrie. Right. Christopher McQuarrie worked on four as well.
Right. He wrote four, I believe.
Yeah, something like that. Kristin Scott Thomas and Emilio Estevez pop up in the beginning. Kristin Scott Thomas was also having a good year with The English Patient. And then Vanessa Redgrave, who plays Max, she's wonderful.
She crushes it in this movie.
She's fantastic. I really love her. And she had been in, you know, a number of different things over the preceding, you know, 20 or 30 years. She's been around for a really long time at this point. So that's the kind of context for the director and the cast, I think. And then do you want to do the premise?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so Mission Impossible, John Voight on a plane gets a secret message. You know, it's coded. The flight attendant says, are you interested in a movie? He says, no. She says, what about if I said it was the cinema of the Ukraine? And he says, okay. He watches it. It's a mission to do a thing.
I love the idea of him saying it like that in the movie. Like, it's the cinema of the Ukraine. Okay.
Okay, I suppose I will. But he watches it. It self-destructs afterwards. It sort of introduces the main players, that Ethan Hunt's going to be his main character, his point man, played by Tom Cruise, of course, and that Emmanuel Baird is his wife, and the thing self-destructs, and off we go. He meets with his team. Tom Cruise is kind of a jocular playboy kind of guy. He's like, he doesn't take anything too seriously. There's a lot of I don't know. There's a lot
very different from the Ethan Hunt of today.
Yeah, exactly. It feels so different because I saw the number six, Mission Impossible 6, right before rewatching this one.
Mm-hmm.
It's bizarre. This is sort of an origin story for the Ethan Hunt who we have now, because he starts off the movie just as a wacky, funny sort of, like, you know, Tom Cruise kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but where he gets to in the end is he's running his little branch of the IMF, and he's a far more serious character. But in the middle, it sort of becomes a murder mystery for a long time, in which he has to try and figure out who killed John Voight and who killed the rest of his team. And turns out there's a mole in the agency. Mm-hmm. He has to start working with the enemy, Max, to get to those answers and eventually to find the people who set him up.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, spoilers, mm-hmm. hopefully you've seen it, it turns out to be John Voight and Emmanuel Baird and all along who had been betraying him.
Yeah. Yeah. And to get there, they got to steal a thing. They got to steal a thing from Langley.
It's the best.
It is the best. It is the reason why this movie has such long-standing cachet.
Yeah.
The rest of it...
This predates Ocean's 11, am I right?
Sure. Yeah, for sure. I really like this movie, and I think it's great.
Oh, great predates, yeah.
But, you know, ultimately, I think that there's a couple of sequences here that really work, and the rest of it is kind of like, meh. So, well, why don't you say what works for you first?
The sequence at Langley, as we were talking about, they start off as firemen, fire people. They come into they're firemen, really. They come into Langley on a fake fire drill orchestrated by Ving, messing with the computer stuff, which is his thing to do. And they get in there, they quickly change clothes, well, I don't know. You've seen it. It's awesome. He gets up in the vents. They start hovering. Mm. I like how they're explaining what they're going to do as you watch it happen.
Yeah.
Which is why I thought of Ocean's 11 pretty amazing.
It's a fantastic example of how to ratchet up tension,
yep.
right? Because they clearly explain the rules of the room,
yeah.
of that particular room, and what will happen if any of those rules are violated. Mm-hmm. And so you have the temperature sensor, you have the pressure sensor, mm-hmm. And you have sort of these consistent movements towards either higher temperature or the idea that the bead of sweat is going to fall off of his forehead and trigger mm-hmm. the pressure sensor. Like the way that it sets it up is really great. And in the meantime, you have these four planes of action that are all sort of streamlined because you're watching Tom Cruise in the room. You're watching Jean Reno try and like shoo away a rat in the vents.
Right.
You have Ving Rhames doing some stuff on the computer in the van, and you have Emmanuel Bayart taking out the gentleman who is normally manning the computer in the room.
Right.
And it's just, there's such narrative economy. It's like a long sequence, but they get a tremendous amount across during that in regards to Tom Cruise's extraordinary competence and also physique, because I can't imagine that it's easy to hang there for that long.
No.
And then they get the disc, the knock list. Yep. The MacGuffin is the knock list, we should say, which is the secret identities of all of the agents that the IMF has embedded around the world.
The CIA, in fact, so like thousands of agents yep. who are in danger of being killed if this thing gets out.
Yeah.
Another great sequence is the whole... I really like the whole first, I guess, 25 minutes, half hour, whatever yeah. it is, when they're in the... Where are they? They're in sort of an embassy or mm-hmm. castle or something.
Yeah, at sort of a gala. To be honest, like the
oh,
things,
they're in Moscow, right? Am I thinking of a different movie now?
They blow up at the Kremlin in number four.
Yeah, that's,
that might be what
that's
you're thinking.
Where I'm at. Yeah, no, that's not what it is.
I can't remember what country it is, to be honest. The two things that work best for me are the opening sequence, which I think is really wonderful. It ratchets up the tension in a similar sort of way, mm-hmm. but also in a really alarming way, because mm-hmm. going into that movie, and I remember seeing this in theaters, like you don't expect that the original team that is introduced is going to be killed.
Yep.
That's like some real sort of Brian De Palma darkness that is brought into this. Mm-hmm. And then the movie sort of veers in a completely different direction than you think that it's going to go. I mean, when you think about this compared to the original show, which was kind of like lighter and breezier and more fun, I mean, this is about the betrayal of a mentor. It's about the death of Emilio Estevez in a really gruesome way.
Yep.
It's about sort of the blackmailing of Tom Cruise by the CIA. Like, it's a really nasty movie in some ways. But that first sequence really sets it up super well. And I love the Langley sequence.
Yeah.
Almost everything else about this movie I could take or leave.
I gotta say, Tom Cruise, it may go without saying, but Tom Cruise is killing it in this movie.
Disagree.
He's great. Like I said, he started off just joking around with his friends, total kid, like, you know, confident but kid like character, and then you fully believe a man changed by the end of the movie, or even by, you know, 40 minutes in.
Yeah,
I do.
I don't know.
No,
not I'm
so
not
much?
There. It feels like I feel it's like a lot of overacting from him. I also just don't like, and I'm saying this with the benefit of hindsight, like personally, I don't really love the character of Ethan Hunt as it was imagined, because he doesn't really have, there's no real, he doesn't really have a character outside of a man under fire. Right, like there's nothing to get a sense of him outside of that, and you know he can do magic tricks with the disc and flip it from one hand to the other or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's just not, it doesn't really work for me as well. And I have to say, like Tom, I love this franchise. This is my, this is tough. I'm not sure whether this or Fast and the Furious is my most beloved, most long running franchise.
Mm-hmm.
But I love them both, and I was like really there for Fallout.
Yeah.
And I think I might have said this in the intro episode, but I think it is really a credit to the quality of all of these films that this first movie that launched the franchise is like basically the fourth best
right.
in the series.
Right.
Because all of the later ones get better and better. To the point where in Fallout, you know, they're you've been with him for so long that there is some like real pathos to that performance and
Absolutely.
To that character.
Yep.
What doesn't work for you?
The most of the middle. Like when Max is on screen, I'm fine. But it's, you know, when you look back at this movie, not having rewatched it in a decade, what do you remember?
Langley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? And
well, people honestly, also remember the train sequence, which we got to talk about.
I didn't remember it that well. I did remember, for whatever reason, I remember that amazing shot at the end of the destroyed chopper with its...
With the blade spinning?
Just slowly coming towards his neck. That is a pretty clear memory for me, but I didn't remember a lot of it other than that. I remember Langley, and I remember him looking at the Bible and typing messages in a lot of different languages to Job, which I think is a pretty cool thing.
This movie has a very funny idea of how the internet works.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's great. Message sent. Just like you type in whatever name you want for yourself, and you send it to anywhere. Okay,
and
know.
Somebody will find it if they are an international criminal power broker.
Oh, they better. They better. But yeah, I mean, pretty weird. There's some shockingly in that I had no recollection of this kind of stuff, really horror movie style sequences, like when he's dreaming and that right after he sends all those emails and John Voight comes back. And
yeah.
Scary, and then it happens for real a little later in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
That stuff's okay. Doesn't, you know, I'm not gonna come out and say it doesn't work for me, honestly. It's just it's not the best parts of the movie. I think the movie's pretty damn good.
Yeah, I think it's good. I mean, I think, you know, weirdly enough, so the sequence on the train is much closer to what the franchise has become over time. But that is the thing that really doesn't work for me. Because it just comes in from a different movie. Like, the first three quarters of it really feel like a very tense, very dark Brian De Palma movie. And all of a sudden at the end, there's like this kind of, I wouldn't quite call it jaunty, but like very traditional action score that kicks in. And he's fighting with John Voight on the top of the train, and then they're jumping onto the helicopter. And it's all, it doesn't work, in my opinion. Like, I think that last shot of the chopper blade getting closer and closer to his throat is sort of ludicrous, as is the idea that Jean Reno is the best helicopter pilot in the world because you can apparently drive or fly a helicopter behind a train.
But all it takes is one shot of his face and he kind of goes, oh, here we go,
before he goes
into the tunnel.
It is ludicrous.
Yeah.
And I do think that the other thing that doesn't really work, like, you know, I don't mind MacGuffins in films if they're going to serve a purpose. I think that the relatively convoluted plot around the Gideon Bible from the Drake Hotel and all of this other stuff, like, it was just a little bit too much in a movie that could have been a little bit clearer and more streamlined.
That's the tip-off, you mean? The Drake Hotel.
I just remember that's like a whole thing. I I'm not sure that I could really 100% explain it.
I'll be honest with you. I really have no idea how that tips him off.
Yeah.
Okay, so the guy's been to the Drake Hotel.
John Voight says that he was
in
the Drake Hotel at some point, and then he finds it in the
room. Maybe he hadn't actually been there. He had to use it as a cover for something.
No, he was there. He took the Bible in order to send messages to Max from the hotel room.
But then Max says Job isn't taken to quoting scripture like you are, or he's not as playful as
that's
you or
true.
Something like that.
Yeah, that's true. I don't
what
know.
What the hell, man?
I'm not sure. It doesn't matter. We're being a little bit nitpicky, because it really is a great movie overall, but there are some parts of it that like really work, and there are some parts of it that just kind of work. The other thing that I just find a little bit weird is the whole... There's just some weird sexual politics around Emmanuel Bayard being sort of traded off between John Voight and Tom Cruise, and the whole sort of mentor-mentee relationship. Like, it's just weird. It doesn't really feel like she has a lot of agency in this movie, outside of just sort of ending up being a villain and then dying, and then that's it.
Yeah, she pretty much does die. She tries to get Voight not to kill Tom Cruise at one point at the end there, but that's pretty much it. Yeah, it's silly. I think as a young person watching it, I didn't really realize that she and John Voight were actually married. Didn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, that's true.
You know what I mean?
Well, so those are the movies that we have to discuss. What we're going to debate these on: commercial success, cultural relevance, and longevity. So what do you think?
Okay, well, what was the difference in the box office? It's actually pretty pretty big difference, like $80 million.
Yeah, for commercial success. Okay, but here's the thing. For commercial success, Twister wins the box office in 1996. However, and I know that this is fudging things a little bit, but Mission Impossible is like at least a $1 billion franchise, if not maybe close to two at this point, after six movies over the course of 22 years.
Yeah, you're very right about that. Although I am searching for Twister movie sequel. It's seeking crowdfunding help. It's been 20 years since the disaster flick Twister hit theaters, but the story's not over. No, the story's over.
There's a GoFundMe for Twister 2?
Yeah, apparently. From 2016, there was.
That's crazy. What there is, and so the thing that I didn't know about when I was looking at Helen Hunt's IMDb page earlier, she is credited in 1998 as being a part of something called Twister, Ride It Out. And I said to myself, huh, what is that? Turns out, Universal Studios Ride.
Ha!
She and Bill Paxton do some voices.
Okay.
I guess they put you in a room and they strap you in with some belts and then they turn on a wind tunnel and you get to fly in the center of a tornado. I have no idea.
Do you get soda?
I don't know.
Okay. If you can drink a can of soda with Lois Smith, then I'm fine.
Okay. The ride is you just get to sit at Lois Smith's imaginary house and eat some of those pancakes.
Oh, yeah. That's good.
Yeah, so I mean, commercial success in the moment, for sure, Twister wins. It was a flashier movie in a lot of ways. Over time, it goes to Mission Impossible.
Okay. I think longevity, you have the same answer.
It's 100% the same. And there will, I mean, I would assume that there will be either a seventh movie with Tom Cruise or, I mean, fingers crossed. I would kind of love it, actually, if this was the last movie with him. Because he's starting to... You're starting to tell that he's not running quite as fast.
He's starting to turn.
He's starting to turn a little bit. But I would be delighted if the reboot focused on Ilsa Faust. I mean, Rebecca Ferguson does such a wonderful job with that character. But on longevity, it wins as well. Cultural relevance, there's kind of no contest.
Twister, obviously, right? Because tornadoes are a thing that happen every day to every people and everyday people.
Here's the thing. I made a mistake picking this movie, picking Twister. Twister is not going to win in this matchup.
No, it's not.
If we had had a different, like if it was Twister versus That Thing You Do, it would be a different discussion. But we pitted these two against each other, these two behemoths against each other.
I think Twister loses to That Thing You Do also, but we're going to see.
That's crazy.
What do you think about the unofficial fourth category of watchability today and how enjoyable it is?
Oh, that's interesting. Which one would I rather watch? I would rather watch Twister as a whole. I would rather watch the 20-minute sequence in Langley on YouTube as opposed to watching all of Twister, though.
Got you. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, if you have 20 minutes.
Yeah. Because Mission Impossible is like, it's a little bit long, and there's like 30 minutes of it that are really good, and then I don't actually love the rest of it.
Right.
It's weird that it ends with Tom Cruise and Ving Rhames sitting at an outdoor pub, drinking beers, and listening to the Cranberries.
I forgot about that. Yeah, you know, of its time.
That doesn't feel like a very De Palma move to me.
No.
It almost, and I don't know, we should have looked this up, it almost feels like at some point somebody was like, no, too dark, let's do something else, we're going to go in a different direction here.
Right. It is a fun movie by the end, and in our memories, more so than it is while you're watching it.
Yeah, I think that's true. But yeah. It led to something that I think is much greater, which is Mission Impossible's 4, 5, and 6.
Oh my God.
All of which I love. Actually, I love 3, too.
I gotta go rewatch 2 and 3. I remember the scene where he's discussing traffic patterns, as that's his cover. Is that 3?
Oh, that's 3. Yeah, so that's when he's at a house party with Michelle Monaghan, and she's like, oh, his job is so boring.
Right.
Yeah.
I liked that scene.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Okay. Love that movie. Actually, you know, sorry, we've missed an important point here where we could decide this matchup on Philip Seymour Hoffman performances alone. Because he is the villain in number 3.
Pretty great villain, too.
You're wonderful villain. Very threatening. The best Mission Impossible villain, perhaps? I think so.
I mean, who's the villain in this one? Voight?
Yeah.
Kinda. It's not like... It's
I think
really
he's better than
clear.
John Voight. I can't really remember Mission Impossible 2. I only saw that once in theaters. Philip Seymour Hoffman is in 3. 4 is a Scandinavian actor who's quite famous, but he's sort of not relevant to the plot. 6 is... what's his name?
5 and 6 are the same guy, right?
Well, kind of. So it's Solomon Lane, and he's in both of them, but he's pretty good. But 6, you get Henry Cavill as well, who I think is really wonderful.
Yeah? You think he's wonderful?
I really liked him in that.
Oh, man. Yeah. I don't know about that.
Okay. Well, I think that we can probably still agree Philip Seymour Hoffman is the best Mission Impossible villain.
Yeah, by far. He's got to be.
100%.
Okay, cool. So this has been talking about the best Mission Impossible villains.
Yeah.
The winner is, of course, Philip Seymour Hoffman and all of us.
Well, no, I mean, it's exciting because now we have our third pick. So what we have Independence Day, that's now locked in.
Yep.
First Wives Club.
Got it.
Mission Impossible.
Great.
And then we have 2 matchups left. So we're doing The Birdcage versus The Rock and Scream versus That Thing You Do.
That is hilarious. I cannot wait to have these discussions. But yeah, this has been great. Thanks everyone for listening, and tune in next time. Write to us with any questions you have. Just type in, questions at snubs and send them away to answers at snubs, and just watch the envelope kind of drift away into the screen.
Just pretend.
We'll get it.
It's 1996 internet. Yeah. 1996 pretend internet.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But we'll get it. We generally search all those message boards as
sure.
long as they have biblical quotes in them.
Yep, 100%.
Yeah, we'll see you then.
Cool. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening. Have a good one.